Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Planner Podcast. I am still recording out of my temporary podcast studio because of the destruction of the former one. We're still working on repairing the sewer backup damage to our house that happened in this big storm. And boy, oh boy, I hope it never happens to you. As you might expect in home, whenever you have a home problem, basically they discovered some like random asbestos. And so now the asbestos people have to call and come and do something, and then hopefully one day I'll have a podcast studio again. If you're watching on our YouTube channel, you're going to notice a pretty hilarious background. Thank you for your patience. I promise the student loan info is good, even though the production value is questionable. LOL. So today I want to talk about something that I think is pretty interesting to reflect on. I want to talk about what will professional salaries be with mass closure of graduate and professional school programs. I think this is a fair question to ask. I don't think it's a mean question to ask because I think it's just about objective reality that we are going to be living in when the Big Beautiful Bill provisions get enforced starting in July 2026. I want to talk about some things. I'm excited to talk to maybe even some aid administrators from graduate and professional school programs to think through how are you going to be handling this? You know, what are you thinking about in terms of the risk to your institution, but also the risk, frankly, to a lot of people's jobs? I'm going to be real honest that I feel the stress of a lot of professional aid, financial aid folks with all these changes that are going to be hitting higher education. I mean, obviously, you know, my wife works at a institution of higher education. And so, you know, there's a lot of question marks right now, to say the least, about all the different things that are going on and will there be layoffs and how will this impact higher ed? So, I mean, I think this is a very relevant thing to talk about, given that we talk to graduate and professional borrowers on this podcast for the most part. So, what do I think is going to happen? So think about the OBBB. I'm just going to call it the beautiful bill because it's easier to say. The beautiful bill, which, you know, can be absorbed with a sense of irony and amusement, by the way, if you want to, me calling it that. Basically, the big change that it makes is capping graduate and professional school borrowing. Really, professional school borrowing is capped at only $50,000 a year. Professional school borrowing capped at $50,000 a year, that's $200,000 in aggregate. That's going to apply to anybody who starts a program of study after July 2026. Now, before that, you get a three-year grandfathering in window where you can borrow the old loan amounts up to 3 years or the completion of your program, whichever's like sooner, basically, right? The expected completion of your program. What I am interested in thinking about is the people joining the fall of this semester, this fall upcoming, you know, really starting right now. The people starting their graduate and professional school programs right now will be able to borrow the remainder of their programs in full, I'm pretty sure. Now, if I misstate something, I'll correct it in a future podcast. But generally speaking, the people that are entering, you know, NYU Dental School this fall should be able to finish out borrowing their $150,000 a year. I think it's actually maybe even $160,000 a year total now, something like that, until the end of, you know, their program term. But if you're enrolled after July 2026, you are capped at $50,000 total loans per year, and that's applicable to anybody who starts a program after July 2026. So let me make some predictions. One thing I think is going to happen is people who, you know, are going to these higher cost programs, I think the schools are going to realize, oh, bleep, we need to start people, you know, in these programs June 30th, 2026. I don't know if some institutions will be able to do that administratively with their bureaucracies, but there's a huge incentive for like a Georgetown Law School or at NYU or somebody that isn't bound by like some state, you know, big regulations that take forever to say, hey, we're going to start everybody as the summer term, you know, because we can get people loan limits of $160,000 a year instead of $50,000. And people actually be able to attend, and they'll just have to hope and pray that they can borrow for their fourth year because the borrowing amounts are capped for 3 years. So there's a big opportunity for huge conflicts of interest for these schools out there, right? Because what happens is living expenses have gone up since the pandemic. So like, it's not unusual to have somebody need to borrow 25 to 30K really to have their living expenses during graduate school. So if you're borrowing 30K for living expenses, you only have $20,000 left over in that budget for tuition, and then also tuition fees, all the health insurance, all the fees that come with attending a graduate or professional degree program. And that's if you're borrowing for professional school. We're not even talking about graduate school, where the cap is, I think, $100,000 for a graduate, you know, non-professional degree program. That's going to be so disruptive. Even some of these public universities, they're going to be hit with the borrowing limits, and they're not going to be adaptive like the private schools will probably be. They'll just start the usual time. They'll just enroll everybody in August or September like they usually always do. And those students next fall will be subject to that $50,000 per year cap of $200,000 total. if you think about what that means, a lot of those in-state schools rely on out-of-state students to subsidize their programs. And a lot of times, a lot of our consults are from like out-of-state students that went to like, I'm just going to pick a random school, University of Missouri. I don't know if they're still doing it this way, but they would borrow 60, 70K for their first year of professional school. And they would be greatly subsidizing all those in-state students. And they would just load up on the Grad Plus loans to cover all that in-state, out-of-state delta on the difference. But that's that opportunity, that pathway with Grad Plus going away next year is going to be closed off. And so that's going to have negative impacts on state schools. So state schools are going to feel this in a big way, especially ones that rely on a lot of out-of-state students to pad their budget. And then for the professional schools that are at private universities, the problem is, you know, if the tuition amount that you need to borrow is, let's call it 50, right, which is a whole bunch of professional programs out there, right, that you need to borrow 50. That means that you're going to need to borrow, you know, let's say your cap after, you know, living expenses, you only have 20 or 25K left over to borrow with federal loans. That's going to mean that you're going to need to borrow like 30K a year, maybe, times four. So it's 120 grand of private student loans. In total, those private student loans are not going to be paid while you're in school. So investors are going to need a higher rate to subsidize them for not getting payments while enrolled in school, maybe 0.5% to 1% higher than you might expect, at least. And so the private student loan rates could easily be, you know, 8, 9, 10% for that 30K per year. And so you've got 120K that grows into 150K by the end of your four-year program. And then you've got to pay, you know, about $1,500 a month. That's 18K a year after taxes. So before taxes, you probably have to earn more like 30K in pre-tax salary to pay that $1,500 a month, right? So let's say 30K of salary is reserved for those private student loan payments. And then on top of that, you're going to have the RAP plan, which will be the only option for people who take out loans after July 2026. And those folks are going to need to pay 10% of their income. And you probably will still be able to do some things like you currently do to put off the full 10% being assessed on you. But when that 10% is assessed, you know, let's say you're a brand new associate dentist or something. So you're paying 10% of, you know, 150K a year. So 15 grand, give or take, you know, around 1200 a month. So 1200 a month times 12, let's just call it 15 grand after taxes, maybe pre-tax salary equivalent, that's 25 grand. And I'm assuming, of course, that that 1500 is, you're assuming you're somebody's borrowing the max, right? So we're assuming here that that 1200 a month payment is lower than the 2000 a month payment that would be the standard 10-year plan. So if you take the 25K of pre-tax income is going towards the RAP plan, 30K of pre-tax income that's going towards your private student loans, you could easily be in the 50K range for a salary going to loans. So if you go to like dental school and you make 150K a year and you're losing 50K of your pre-tax salary towards loans, so your pre-tax, like you're netting, you know, 100 at that point. That's kind of a rough trade. Now, I think it's still probably a good trade long-term if you're comparing that path to just being an undergrad-only grad that just goes and gets your undergrad degree and works in corporate America, right? You probably do have more upside potential still, even in that scenario where you're having to borrow, you know, 30K a year of private student loans. You're still probably better off financially because think about the math that I just ran. 100K pre-tax salary is 100K more or less than you'd make as an undergrad making 60K a year. Well, it's obviously a lot more. Do you have a lot more upside as a dentist to do it in a practice ownership scenario, working in a more rural area, have an income that's twice that amount? Or if you become a practice owner in a good spot, maybe it could be three times that 150K amount. I've certainly seen plenty of dentists that have that income that have worked with us over time. There's plenty of upside, but then also you can make the argument, well, if somebody's smart enough to go to professional school, they're also smart enough to go do something else that might be higher paying than just that regular undergrad job that you would get with a college degree somewhere in corporate America, for example. So what does that do to current doctors and professionals and graduate school degree holders, right? What it does is it's going to mean that certain schools, like the one that needs somebody to borrow 30K a year, I mean, maybe somebody's willing to underwrite that. But if you have somebody that's graduating with a greater than 2-to-1 debt to income ratio, which is honestly most dental schools and most vet schools and most medical school is a little bit unique case, right? Because of the residencies and such like that. But most professional programs out there, in many cases, have people graduating with more than a 2-to-1 debt to income ratio. And that's because of Grad Plus. And it's because The schools that put out the most graduates in many cases are the ones that popped up after the Grad Plus program came out in 2006 that allowed for unlimited borrowing. So as an example, you can see this in the number of pharmacy schools. So the Pharmacy School Association puts out a really good survey of like how many pharmacy schools there were by every year. So it's really easy to like research this historically compared to some of these other programs that I've found that are harder to research. And I did this, you know, obviously before ChatGPT existed, so it was a little bit more manual back in the day. But I remember this because it was flooring when I saw the results. Back in like mid-2000s, there were like 40 pharmacy schools, give or take. And then Grad Plus came out in 2006, and within like 5 years, it was 90 pharmacy schools. The acceptance rate for pharmacy school used to be in the low 30 percentile range. Within 10 years of Grad Plus, the acceptance rate was in the high 70 percentile range, I believe. And then by the 2010s, the acceptance rate for pharmacy school was like 85% or 90% almost in some cases. So what happened is anything that didn't have any point of friction to enter the profession, like for example, medicine has residencies. You have to go through that to be able to become a doctor. So there's a restriction on the supply of physicians entering the market, which is why you haven't seen as much difficulty in the medical field like you've seen in some of these other fields that don't have some sort of friction point to enter the field, right? So for example, there's not as much of a friction point to go become a pharmacist or a physical therapist or even a dentist. It's only the number of schools. Why have pharmacist earnings been a little bit more slow growth than you might really think and hope for? Well, a big reason for it is because the number of schools tripled. It went from 40 schools to 120 schools. When you have a supply shock that causes the number of pharmacists to double or triple, if that supply is greater than, you know, the increase in demand, which I think it, you maybe can make an argument that in some cases it, well, it doesn't really matter, because what happens is if you have a big supply shock where you're introducing way more graduates, salaries go down or they are going to grow more slowly, right? Employers that employ people with those degrees have a lot more leverage because they have a lot more employees to choose from. And so a lot of people get frustrated by Delta Dental, for example, or, you know, private equity in the veterinary space, or, you know, pick your poison of any number of like annoying employers that have a lot of leverage over new grads in any given professional field. A lot of the reason they have that leverage is because of Grad Plus. It might be kind of weird to say that. Some people might be upset by hearing that, or maybe disagree rather, and we could certainly have a reasonable debate about it. But when you have way more people entering a field, you know, if you have way more people enter a field, you have the supply shock, and then you're going to have more people that are driving down wages in the field because you have so many graduates. On the plus side, getting a professional degree is still overall a really great deal, especially under the current student loan rules that existed before this beautiful bill. If you just paid 10% of your income, then all you have to do is take your after professional degree income, take away 10%, take away a little bit more for saving for the tax bomb, and then compare that to what you would have done if you hadn't gone to that program. And literally like 95% of the time, it's a great investment. 95% of the time with the old IDR rules, you know, going to professional school net of what you're paying on student loans and tax bomb was more, or even in most cases, it's at least double what you would earn as an undergraduate only. Not in every field, but in a lot of fields, it's like 1.5 to 2 times as much after adjusting for the student loan deductions from IDR, right? So that's what we always say, well, student loans, a worst case scenario, are just an income tax, because that they are under the old loan regime that's going to persist, luckily, for existing borrowers. But for future borrowers, you're going to be stuck with the decision of, do I borrow, you know, $30,000 extra in private loans per year at a high interest rate to get this degree? A lot of people are going to say, I don't like that. I don't want to do that. And in certain cases, when you have like a USC or an NYU that charge or have a total cost of like $150,000 between living expenses and tuition and fees, no one's going to pay that unless you're from a very wealthy family. And I think I saw one of those schools published that they had 3,000 applicants for like 340 something spots or something like that, right? So like a 10% acceptance rate. Well, for one, a lot of those 3,000 applicants are probably applying around to a lot of different places. But then if those folks know that, hey, I'm only going to this school if I'm wealthy, then what's going to happen is the demand of people applying to these schools is going to drop off a ton. And the schools are probably going to start tuition discounting. I would be shocked if by next fall you don't see some extremely aggressive tuition discounting in the graduate and professional school market, exactly like you do currently in the undergrad market. And what's going to happen, I think, is you're going to start seeing schools giving quote-unquote merit scholarships, which actually isn't, I'm not trying to be mean, it's not a merit scholarship at all. It's them calculating how much do they think that you will pay, how much do you think you are able to pay, and they're going to give you that offer to sign up and pay that amount. That's basically the dirty little secret for any school that's not like the most prestigious Ivy League school for the undergrad market, is most of these schools, not all, but most of them hire very, you know, fancy consultants to run algorithms to calculate based off of this parent's income, assets, FAFSA, whatever, how much do we think that they will actually pay? And then they give everybody their opening aid offers, and the people who know how the game is played will reply back to the aid offices and say, can you use professional judgment and increase my award, right? And then oftentimes, a lot of these aid offices, they do that because they're just literally price discriminating, like economics would predict, to try to maximize their profits for the school. So I think the same thing is going to happen for graduate school outside of more like the ones that have been around forever, like the big in-state medical school that's been around since 1900, whatever. Like, they're going to probably go on, like they've always been going on. They're probably not going to necessarily engage in as much tuition discounting, right? And if I was a graduate student or professional student that was looking at programs and I was looking at entering a program after July 2026, I would be a little cautious about attending any program that started and opened its doors after 2006. Why? Any program that started before 2006 would have been economically viable under the old loan rules that had way lower limits, that had a lot more obligation to repay. That means those institutions before that date were mostly producing economically viable graduates if you had to pay back all the loans, which the model is moving towards. The programs that came out after 2006, what I predict is a lot of them are going to close their doors, and some of them will survive because some of them are viable, good programs that produce economically viable graduates. But if I had offers of enrollment for different professional schools that I wanted to go to, I would put a lot more stock on a program that's been around since before 2006, and I would be very cautious before I, especially before taking out private student loans in a program that started up after 2006. Why? If these schools close down, you will probably get closed school discharge if you're not able to transfer the credits somewhere else in your federal loans. But remember that your federal loans might be a small subset of your overall borrowing amount. So the private student loans might still be owed. And bankrupting private student loans is not going to be easy during this administration at a minimum. It's already wasn't easy in the prior administration. And so, you know, you just think about all these complexities for students. What do you do? Do you throw up your hands? Well, don't lose hope. There are going to be negative impacts from this bill. If the impacts are very negative in a way that is politically sensitive, I predict that Congress will look at making some changes once they realize what the impact of what they did actually was. So, for example, I think I looked at a bunch of different red districts and swing districts in major battleground states for Congress. I looked at a dozen to half dozen districts that had a random like liberal arts college that employed a huge amount of the rural population in that district. And so those institutions, if they are really reliant on Parent PLUS loans, now that those Parent PLUS loans are capped at just $50,000, like that's really low, a lot of those schools will go out of business. What could happen is if you have some of those schools go out of business, they have to lay off a lot of the people in the districts. A lot of those Congress people that voted for this bill wanting to send a message to downsize higher education might look at the political reality of, oh my gosh, I got a lot of angry voters. I'm going to lose my race if I don't try to save my institution, you know, by making some changes to the student loan rules. I think there will be some appetite for that, but it's not going to be there. The appetite won't be there until after they see what they already did. So July 2026, that's the date that everything changes. For people this fall and even this spring, you can kind of a little bit go on as business as usual. I would just say that I would be really careful for Parent PLUS borrowers that are taking anything out in January 2026 because you'd have to be able to consolidate those before that July 2026 deadline or you'd be in deep trouble. So I would say that the only people who have to be super careful about borrowing before July 2026 are the Parent PLUS borrowers borrowing in the spring semester that's coming up this year. Everybody else, though, after July 2026 needs to be extremely careful, and there's going to be a whole new model of financing higher education for graduate and professional degree holders. And, you know, it's just going to be really interesting to watch this all unfold. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen. I mean, maybe I'm overstating the number of closures that might happen because maybe there's just a bunch of wealthy families out there that want to send, on average, maybe compared to today, maybe a little bit less academically qualified students on average to become a fill-in-the-blank profession because now maybe they weren't getting approved, you know, and this is all averages, right? Obviously, there's plenty of talented students from not wealthy families and wealthy families, of course, but the students that are not from the wealthy families, you know, if they can't afford to go to these professional programs, some of those spots will get filled by people who can afford to pay full freight, right? That might not have gotten into the school otherwise. What I really hope happens is, you know, a lot of times schools are not very creative. I mean, just schools, in a lot of cases, for example, there's in-state programs in certain parts of the country. It's like they're low-cost areas. The cost of living is low. You know, why don't they offer up more seats? Well, you know, why are they not opening more opportunities for people to go through their programs? It's kind of interesting that a lot of these programs that reacted to Grad Plus were private institutions in really high cost of living areas, because I think that they had very maybe business-minded administrators, right? And they're just looking at it like a revenue game. Like, oh, wow, I can open up a dental school spot and I can charge them $100,000 a year and they'll pay it. That's going to subsidize all kinds of projects that we want to do. And they'll pay the same percent of their income if they borrow 50 or 150. So we might as well maximize our revenues. And, you know, you have the in-state schools that kind of are a little bit less reactive and I think maybe business-oriented in their approach to things. I hope a lot of those lower-cost schools, like middle-of-nowhere kind of schools that have low costs of living, will hopefully consider opening up more space so that we don't have as bad of a shortage in professional schools out there. So we will continue helping current borrowers navigate this mess of student loan repayment. I'll certainly do more episodes on the existing state of student loans. I just thought it would be interesting because the impact on existing borrowers, I do think that salaries are going to go up a lot over time because of this bill if it stays. Not saying that that's a good thing. I just think that that's the objective reality that will happen. And the reason, again, is because if you have, you know, a doubling or tripling in the number of schools that's occurred since 2006 in a lot of these fields, if the number of schools gets cut by even a quarter, but probably more like 50% in a lot of cases, right? Then the number of grads is going to get cut somewhere between 20 and 50%. And if you limit the supply, it's not going to happen right away. But if you have 5 to 10 years worth of low numbers of new graduates, that's going to increase the price that the providers can charge that are already in the field. And so that's going to be, at a minimum, supportive of you reaching financial goals. It might be depressing, but it might also be supportive because it means you're going to have lower risk of unemployment. You're going to have less competition from private equity that can hire very cheap labor because they're, you know, super burdened by student debt. You will have more opportunity for upside. And also, like, you know, the DSOs of the world will have less leverage to negotiate, you know, rock bottom prices to providers because they won't be able to get as many people that will say yes. That's ultimately what determines market prices, is do people say yes to things that a Delta Dental type of DSO asks for? If people are saying yes to it, they're probably going to do it. But if they're not getting anybody that says yes, or they're not getting enough people that say yes, then provider payments go up. I mean, it's just literally economics. And, you know, it's also going to make some, like I said, very unfortunate changes too about making the average student that goes to professional school much wealthier. But again, we have to live in the objective reality of what is. And I do think that people that are worried about their job security and professional degree holding situations, I think that you should feel very confident that your job security is pretty rock solid on average. Kind of unfortunate that it's happening like this. I mean, I remember having some conversation with somebody that was like, yeah, well, you know what? I care a lot more about NIH funding and that getting cut than I do about getting extra benefits from the SALT deduction or having to compete with fewer new grads or something like that. So totally valid point of view. If that's your point of view, of course, again, I'm not trying to say what should be. I'm trying to say, what do I think is and what is down the road, what is coming. For the people who are financial aid administrators, if I was a financial aid administrator at a private school, I probably would be having, you know, conversations with administration of, hey, if we want to have a big class this next fall, we're going to have to talk to people and tell them the truth, which is, hey, you're going to have to borrow a ton of private loans in year four. And, you know, if we want to have a big class, we should have people start June 30th, 2026, so they can borrow 3 years at unlimited borrowing amounts. And then year four, you have to take out private loans. And then if I worked at, you know, an in-state school or a lower cost school, I'd feel very good about my job security. If anything, what's going to happen is those lower cost schools are going to get inundated with more applications. They're going to become a lot more competitive because people are going to realize, oh, if I want to have the dream of being a doctor, it's not between this low cost school and high cost school, and I can borrow the unlimited amounts for either one. My dream of becoming a veterinarian, physician, dentist, lawyer, whatever, it might literally come down to, can I get into my low cost in-state school? And so you're going to see a lot more competition for these, you know, in-state public programs that don't cost as much too, since people are having to pay the actual cost now for the most part. Some people will be going for forgiveness still, but it's just going to be a little bit more uncommon. I think physical therapists borrowing the max $200K loan amount or something, those probably on average still will go for forgiveness even under the RAP plan, but a lot of programs are not going to be in the future. So if you have any questions, leave them on our voicemail line, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. If you have any feedback, of course, you can always email us. If you need to get a student loan consult to maybe get out of the save forbearance or to understand, What does it mean long term being on this IBR plan or this pay plan? Or what should I be thinking about with the new PSLF changes to qualifying employers that they're discussing? Anytime you need to talk about your loans, you can get a consult with us if you prefer, studentloanplanner.com/book. And then wealth clients reach out to your financial planner if you work with us for that. Thank you so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Have a great rest of your day. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.